Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, broadcasting from my living room, taking the advice of public health experts to work from home and limit social contacts. I'm connected to the studio at WHYY in Philadelphia, where engineer Al Banks and producer Debbie Builder have set up this interview with producers John Ahrens and Kelsey Hansen, working remotely on their computers from their homes. My dog has been sequestered in the kitchen. This is a first for all of us, and assuming that everything works, it will be the way we produce Radio Times in the days, maybe even the weeks ahead. These are tough times for everyone. We know that. And I'm lucky we have this workaround because the show must go on. The country has had presidential elections in the middle of a war, during an economic crisis, in the midst of a financial meltdown, but never during a global pandemic. A crisis is the ultimate test for a president, which reveals their fitness for office. Vice President Joe Biden swept the three primaries yesterday, winning in Florida, Illinois, and Arizona, and taking a commanding lead over Senator Bernie Sanders. Joining us from his phone, from his home, I should say, is Will Bunch. He's national political columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, nice to have you on the show.
Yeah, hi, Marty. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Eddie Glaude Jr. also joining us, assuming from his home as well, and he's a professor at Princeton University. He's got a new book coming out very shortly about James Baldwin called Begin Again. And Eddie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's a pleasure. Glad to be with you.
And to our listeners, I want to make sure that you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me begin with a kind of a basic question. And Eddie, I'll begin with you. Can we run a presidential primary in the middle of a pandemic?
I think so. I mean, we saw amazing turnout last night. When you think about the numbers, say, in Florida, they surpassed 2016. Had a lot to do with early voting. We saw Washington State, in some ways, the epicenter of the crisis. They held their primary, and that had a lot to do with mail-in voting. So, what we've experienced over the last few years have been attempts to, in some ways, make it more difficult for people to vote. What this moment suggests to us is that if we continue along the path of early voting, mail-in voting, and the like, that we could, in fact, continue to have our democracy work if we follow those pathways. But I do want to say this: that I saw long lines in Illinois, particularly in communities of color. I thought they were extraordinarily dangerous for particularly the elderly folk who were there. So we have much more work to do here, but I think we can do it if we're a little bit more deliberate and self-conscious.
Well, let me put a similar question, but I'll frame it slightly differently. I'm also thinking that a campaign in a time of this level of crisis is also a test for leadership, a test for who can be the president who can lead us through this difficult time. Do you see it that way?
Well, certainly the candidates see it that way. I mean, you've seen this amazing shift, and necessity is the mother of invention, right? So clearly there can't be large rallies, and which is bad for all the candidates. It's particularly bad for one candidate, Bernie Sanders, because so much of the energy around his campaign is around these huge rallies they have. I actually went out to Southern California for Super Tuesday and went to his big rally in Los Angeles, where they had 24,000 people, you know. In fact, I was probably lucky to get out of there with my health, given the way
this was
right on March 1st. But so what we're seeing now is we're seeing, Bernie Sanders had this fireside chat Sunday night. Both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders have given these kind of presidential style addresses with the American flags lined up behind them. And it's kind of reinventing the way you run for president, right? Because it's like they're auditioning to, can you imagine President Joe Biden, how he would deal with this crisis? Or can you imagine President Bernie Sanders and how he would deal with this crisis? And it's a very different type of campaign. I think it's instructive for voters. We have the technology to do these things, and they're taking advantage of it. Something's lost and something's gained, I think.
Well, and it's hard to know exactly what to make of all the results, but Eddie, it's clear that Joe Biden has been winning hand over foot in the last couple of primaries. Does that tell us something about, and I should say winning by large numbers, does that tell us something about what voters say they want? Do they want someone who looks familiar to them, who perhaps even has ties to the Obama administration, where that administration was able to handle some of these really difficult crises?
I think so. I mean, look, after we came out of Nevada and New Hampshire, there was a kind of full-blown panic that in some ways drove the news cycle. The fear that the Democratic Party was about to nominate a Democratic socialist who many believed, and Mike Bloomberg, of course, pushed this narrative that he could not beat Donald Trump. And so what we saw is the old political card being played of fear, and fear motivated a lot of folks who were in some ways and who remain in some ways in agreement with some of the policies that Bernie Sanders embraces, but who are in some ways more committed to getting Trump out of office than trying, to implement a transformative agenda. And then there are those people, Marty, who support Biden, who want to return to a sense of normalcy. There's a sense in which, in the face of the crisis that is Donald Trump and the crisis that is the coronavirus, people are looking for safety. And I think they're looking for safety in the familiar. And I think in this moment where the country faces such a profound crisis, we need to look forward and not backwards. But that's a difficult case to make in this moment.
Absolutely. And I noticed that Joe Biden is pivoting, I would say, towards a national election. He is trying to welcome Bernie Sanders and his supporters into the fold. He even said last night, I hear you when you're talking about some of the crises that face so many people in this country, whether it's about college debt or not having insurance or not having sick leave. Do you think Biden can sort of pull Democrats together, assuming he becomes the candidate?
I hope so. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You go ahead, Will, and then Eddie, I'll go right back to you. Go ahead, Will.
We could both probably address this. But, I think, Marty, you hit exactly on what's happening here, and I think it's fascinating. You know, it's interesting when you said that he's doing this to pivot to the national election, which I think is true, but it's funny because, traditionally, and this is the – this is the 10th presidential election I've covered now. And usually when you say somebody pivots to the election, it means they pivot to the center normally, right? You know, that they would be worried about how do I get independents, moderates, and even, moderate Republicans to consider voting for me. Instead, I think this is a big lesson from 2016. I think Biden realizes his best preparation for the general election is to make sure that Bernie Sanders voters, and also let's not forget Elizabeth Warren voters, of which I was one. Making sure that those voters are on board and that they're going to show up and vote in November. And so it's really been striking in the last couple of weeks since it's become pretty clear that Biden is all but really clinched the nomination, and yet he's really moved to embrace a lot of the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren agenda. To me, a really significant development a few days ago was Biden announced that he's adopting Elizabeth Warren's college plan, to make college free, I think was up to $125,000. Public universities. And a couple other policy things. I think you saw in the debate Sunday night, Biden is really running much further to the left than he's ever run in his political career. So, he's absolutely doing that. I think the strategy is to make sure that the entire party is on board and to try and maximize turnout in November. And I think it's impressive. I think it's very smart politics on his part.
But I also think, Eddie, it speaks to the times. I mean, what we're learning from this virus is how many people don't have sick leave, or how many people live paycheck to paycheck, how many people, especially, you know, people that work in restaurants and drive Uber cars here and there. I mean, how do we support those people that really live in the margins?
I mean, that's such a great point. See, for the last 40 years, we have lived in a political frame, lived with a political ideology that has in some ways shredded the social safety net. It has assumed that government's role was simply to ensure the efficiency of the economy. And in thinking about that, not in terms of workers, but more in terms of shareholders, as we've seen the financialization of the economy, and also ensuring the national defense as we've engaged in this seems like a never-ending war. And what we've seen over these 40 years is that everyday ordinary folk, everyday ordinary workers have experienced more precarity. Their lives, they're more vulnerable to these sorts of shifts. So what we're experiencing now, Marty, is the ugly underbelly of American society, where the most vulnerable among us are being hit by this crisis in every way imaginable. So you're not only talking about service workers in the service economy, which we are predominantly, but we're talking about those in the gig economy. We're talking about contract workers. We're talking about, you know, like when we think about what happened in San Francisco, where they're sheltering in place in San Francisco County. Think about the population of homeless in that county and what's happening there. So what Bernie Sanders failed to do in the debate on Sunday, and what we have to continue to ask of Biden in this moment, is that the scale of the crisis we face as a society requires a response that is at scale. And it can't be just simply a return to what was, because what was actually produced what I just described, or at least helped produce what I just described. We have to continue to push, I think, the Democratic nominee to put forward an agenda that responds to the scale of the crisis we are currently experiencing.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, but Will, you had a piece in today's paper, I believe it was, in the sense how the virus has exposed what's wrong with our country, but also what is possible.
Yeah, I think this is a moment where, you know, and I want to phrase this the right way because I don't want to sound like, that I'm being an optimist that this is good news. But I mean, this crisis has created a moment where any and all things are really possible. You know, I was actually joking yesterday on Twitter about, a year ago, people were calling Andrew Yang crazy, right, for suggesting giving people $1,000 a month. Not his fans, but some people were calling him that. And now you've got, you know, Mitt Romney and Tom Cotton and people like that endorsing at least for this crisis. And, I wrote a column last week, actually, kind of also similar to today's column about what I was calling disaster socialism, which is the kind of the flip side of disaster capitalism that, these problems that and Eddie addressed it very well. I mean, these problems have been hiding in plain sight for 40 years, like you said, you know. The nickeling and diming of the working class and the marginalized classes in this country. And now all of a sudden we're seeing it. And
well, you know what, Will, hold on. Hold on only because they're playing my song and we have to take a very short break.
Okay.
We are in three different houses and we've got hook up to WHYY. It's Radio Times. We're talking about campaigning for president in the middle of a pandemic. Will Bunch, Eddie Claude Jr. will stay with us more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about politics, campaigning in the midst of a national public health emergency. And again, our guests are Eddie Glaude Jr. He's a professor at Princeton University, Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And you can join our conversation by sending us an email. And I'm just scrambling here to find all my little pieces of paper on my desk. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and we do want to hear what you're thinking about as you watch the race for the White House and how you feel about the issues, the candidacy, what matters to you. Well, let's talk about presidents. and how they have handled crises. And I'm thinking of Ronald Reagan and the Challenger explosion. I'm thinking of President Obama speaking at untold numbers of massacres when there were shootings in churches and in schools. And I'm thinking of our current president, Donald Trump, who said yesterday, this is a pandemic. I felt it was a pandemic long before it was called a pandemic. And Eddie, nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, I mean, we know that he's told close to 17,000 lies in the 3.5 years he's been in office. He told another one yesterday. I mean, in some ways, we know who Donald Trump is. We shouldn't be surprised that the way in which he's approached this pandemic has been self-interested. He is preoccupied with being reelected. And we know that the early decisions that in some ways put the country behind the eight ball were made precisely because of his own selfishness. And so I think it's important for us to understand who he is and to understand what follows from that. And what has followed from that, I think, has been a kind of gaggle of incompetence, even as they try to get themselves together. And what we've seen instead is at the local and state level, we see leadership being exercised as folk wait for the national government to come up with a coherent plan for the country. But I think yesterday, as the other press conferences revealed, Donald Trump is who we know him to be, if that makes sense. Although yesterday was an improvement, I should say that.
Fair enough. Will, I mean, can he write his own personal history?
Well, you know, it's interesting when Eddie says yesterday is an improvement, and he's right, it was an improvement. But, you know, again, it's always motivated by self-interest. You know, for 2 months, I mean, he's hinged the entire self-esteem of his presidency on the stock market. And, you know, he correctly understood from day one that this pandemic had the potential to crash the stock market, which it has. So he spent 2 months just praying it would go away and that this wouldn't happen so he could run on the economy. And, you know, I think over the weekend, kind of a switch went off in his head where he says, well, the stock market's already crashed now. You know, the pandemic is here. The best thing I can do for myself is to try and be, you know, the Winston Churchill of 2020, you know, and that's the switch he turned on. You know, I'm going to be a wartime president. And, first of all, I mean, that would mean forgetting everything that just happened in the last 2 months, you know, and the other thing is, and I was thinking about this as Eddie was speaking. I mean, we hinge so much of how we evaluate a president on, you know, on their style. And like you said, you mentioned the example of Ronald Reagan and the Challenger, but, you know, how they addressed the nation, the words they used and the tone that they set. And I don't want to minimize that. That's very important. Sure. But also, I mean, the administration's response is also part of the team. Who does he have in these key positions and what type of administration has he run for the last 3 years? You know, and Donald Trump has gutted the federal government. I mean, he's put clowns and imposters in so many of these top positions, and then so many of these other key positions have gone unfilled. You know, smart, qualified people didn't want any part of his administration. They left and they weren't replaced. And I think you're seeing the gaps. I mean, we're going to, you know, it's important what Trump says, but it's also important that, like, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers knows what it's doing. You know, it's important that that HHS knows what it's doing. And all of these agencies have been diminished during Donald Trump's presidency.
It's also interesting, Eddie, just how, I mean, it's clear over the last 3 years that President Trump has retained the support of some, you know, low, mid 40% of the population. So it will be interesting to see if that moves at all based on how he has handled this crisis.
Well, I mean, we will see. I mean, it's touching everybody, right? This is not some event that only affects a particular population. Even though they try to describe the virus as a foreign virus to appeal to American nativism and the like, it's gonna touch people's grandmothers, their nanas, their big mamas, you know. And so it's really important for Trump and his political operatives to understand that as the virus continues to impact the day-to-day lives of folk, we're going to hear voices among his core base, like we're hearing among some of his Republican supporters. You hear Newt Gingrich saying, this is serious. You hear folk telling people that the messaging from the White House is disturbing the market. He needs to be clearer. So I think there are folks around him, and I may be wrong here, maybe a bit too optimistic, folk around him and the folk people who support him understand that this is serious business. And if he fumbles the ball, that there could be some serious losses here, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And Will, you had an article also looking at the viewers of Fox News and other kinds of conservative media, many of whom are Trump supporters, who were also passing along misinformation.
Oh, yeah.
Misinformation that was that was putting people's lives at risk. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to pivot to that even before you brought it up, because I mean that's so important. I mean, first of all, I think, you know, when you try and figure out how does Trump's approval rating stay in the mid-40s, you know, I mean, today's politics, I think, is so much a function of the media world that we've created for ourselves. And basically, you know, 40% of the country is living in that conservative media bubble. So when Trump was denying it, Fox News and the rest of conservative media like talk radio was denying it. You know, when Trump says, I'm going to try and become a wartime president and portray myself as a strong leader, all of a sudden Fox and talk radio pivots, and now they're calling Trump a strong leader. So people approve. But, the thing is, the median age of a Fox News Channel viewer is 65 years old.
Wow.
And the statistics show, which means that half of their viewers are over age 65. And statistics show that the older you are, unfortunately, the deadlier the coronavirus is. So the people in this age bracket who absolutely need the best information, you know, since January have been getting the worst information. And it's really tragic. And, and the thing is, I think most of us, those of us who are I'm almost in that age bracket now myself, but, you know, we all have, we all have like in-laws and parents and uncles who are older, who get all of their information from Fox News. And I know from my own life and others, you know, we've had to talk to these people and say, you need to stop going out to the diner, you know, back when the diner was open. You know, you need to, you know, you don't go to the movies, you know, and we've had to have these conversations because, Fox News spent 2 months telling people that this was some kind of liberal hoax, you know, that the liberals want to control your lives. And here's another example of that. And, we've had to break through that whole attitude. It's just been an added layer of dimension to this whole crisis.
And thank goodness, Eddie, for and Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Yeah, you know, I think it was important, especially in the beginning. We needed to hear facts. What we heard instead was the kind of sycophancy of Vice President Pence. You know, as everything became about at the president's direction, his great leadership, and da 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 da. And Dr. Fauci has been and continues to be a voice of reason. Someone who has been straightforward with the country about what is at stake. There are moments where you can see his hands are tied by the political realities. But again, what we need in this moment, and we're beginning to see it, is ongoing efforts to inform the public about what the stakes are. What's happening? Because when we don't fill the space with facts, information that matters, people are going to fill it with fantasy, and it's going to deepen their panics and fears. And I think we saw that in the beginning, and folks are trying to get a handle of it now, but we have even more difficult days ahead.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Eddie Glaude Jr. He's a professor at Princeton University. In fact, he's got a forthcoming book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and Its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. Also with us, Will Bunch. He's national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We are talking about running for the White House in the midst of a pandemic. And again, we want to hear from you. We are not using our phones today because all three of us are at our home and we're testing out this new technology. But you can join our conversation. We want to know what you think of the race, who your candidate might be and what you want the country to deal with moving forward, and certainly our elected leaders. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, let me pick up on what you said earlier about disaster socialism. And this is something, again, that you wrote about in the Inquirer, talking about, again, as a kind of opportunity to deal with the systemic problems that have been really revealed by this virus. What do you mean by disaster socialism?
Well, I mean, a couple of the first things that came up in this crisis, you know, one is the whole paid leave situation. And there's been a movement that really gained steam in the last 10 years in this country. You know, we've seen it right here in Philadelphia, where I'm based, city council took up a paid leave measure, and you had these big corporations like Comcast, for example, here in Philly, that lobbied heavily against these bills and chamber of commerce type groups. And, they've been watered down to extent, to an extent that they did pass. But, we did enact the law here in Philadelphia in 2019, but it was watered down somewhat. And, now with this crisis, people are realizing, oh my gosh, we're telling people that they have to stay home so they don't infect other people. But if they stay home, they're not going to get paid. And if they don't get paid, we're going to have a recession, which we are now. You know, and so, you know, you have this realization. I mean, the big debate for the last year in the Democratic presidential primary has been Medicare for all. And, here's the government saying, you know, oh my gosh, we have uninsured people who can't pay to get these coronavirus tests that they need. We're going to have the government step in and pay for these tests. And, the things that we're willing to do for people in this crisis, you know what? It's a crisis when anybody gets sick. It's a crisis when somebody gets their job, not just from the coronavirus, but from the 900 other sicknesses that we have out there. And so I think this is creating this realization of just how far that we've let the safety net in this country slide over the last 40 years, 30 or 40 years, and, you know, how far we've gone. And we're looking at all the things that we don't have in this country that they have enough in almost every other developed country, certainly in Europe and a number of other places. And we're starting to ask, why don't we have these things, you know? And it's really, you know, just in the course of two or three weeks, has just changed the political debate in my mind so much.
Well, and we've got Congress trying to figure out how to get essentially $1 trillion worth of spending out into the economy. And I wonder, Eddie, do you think America is capable of making dramatic, bold, even revolutionary change under these circumstances?
Absolutely. As Will was talking, I was trying to keep myself in my seat. I was jumping up and down, just shouting, because he's so right. Well, I wasn't shouting. But I think we do have the capacity. And see, the thing is that, you know, what we're calling revolutionary, if we think outside of the frame of the age of Reagan, we would see that we've tried these things before, right? That there was a robust conversation in the United States before the election of Reagan in 1980, and in some ways before the election of Jimmy Carter, about a living wage, full employment. People act like City College wasn't free, you know, or that the University of Wisconsin-Madison didn't become the extraordinary public institution that it was, by osmosis, or that the UC system wasn't as good as it is, and it cost as much as it does as it costs today. No, we actually have done some of this stuff before. It's just that we have been, in some ways, constrained by a political ideology called Reaganism. That has in some ways captured our imaginations. But here we are in this moment, right? It's a convergence of economic realities, of deepening wealth inequality, and this pandemic that reveals the bankruptcy of that ideology. We have to do something bolder, at least in my view, right? Otherwise, the most vulnerable among us, and even those who aren't vulnerable, those who stand on the cusp of precarity, will find themselves losing tremendous ground, and the United States will be looking at an even deeper crisis.
You know, as you were talking, both of you talking, I'll put this to you, Will. I was thinking how we hear people say we're the best country in the world. We're the best country that ever existed. And I love this country. But if you think you're the best, then you don't have to change or fix anything. And now we see that South Korea is doing a better job than the United States, that Singapore, I mean, they have different policies, obviously different kind of government, able to deal with this pandemic in a way that we have not.
That's a fascinating point, Marty, because it's funny, because you're right, because this is a pandemic that, you know, has already affected, you know, at least half the countries in the world, if not more, and by the end, it's going to affect everyone, right? And
yeah.
In a bizarre way, it's given us a way to measure ourselves against all these other countries, and we can see statistically that we're just not measuring up, you know, that the number of tests, you know, is so far behind South Korea, and it's pretty much behind almost every other country as well. And, you know, as this crisis deepens and hopefully we can flatten the curve. But if we don't flatten the curve, and if we see cases continue to spike in the United States, I think that's a great point, that it's going to really kind of shake in our belief in this American exceptionalism, you know, that we have the best healthcare system, that we have the best government. The key to solving a problem, though, is recognizing that you have that problem. And I think, you know, maybe if we kind of remove this, this veil of American exceptionalism that has caused us not to examine ourselves more closely, I think that's why we're talking about these things like sick leave and Medicare for all and living wages and things that have been almost fringe issues until now, and now, in this new context, I think everything is on the table.
Eddie, a little humility.
Always, you know, I think it's very difficult for us to be humble as a country, because I think we often engage in an ongoing refusal to confront the ugliness of who we are. Right, the fact that we could live in a society that incarcerates so many people. The fact that we could be the richest country in the history of the world and have babies wondering where their next meal will come from, right? Folk living in the street. So a little humility and, you know, nothing like a virus that can do this. Nothing like a pandemic that can humble one.
Well, much more to talk about after this very short break. That's Eddie Glaude Jr., also with us, Will Bunch. We're talking about a whole host of things, including the pandemic and how it has affected our way of life and all our institutions. We'll be right back. As we know,
supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Coronavirus is affecting everything, including the presidential campaign. It was a big topic. The Sanders-Biden debate on Sunday has delayed some primaries, although there were some primaries yesterday, and has put a spotlight on the White House handling of the pandemic. We're talking about politics in the midst of a national public health emergency. Again, Eddie Glaude Jr., professor at Princeton University, joining us by phone from his home. Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, he is joining us by phone from his home, and I'm on my phone at my home and talking with you. And again, we want to hear from you, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Tell us what you're thinking as we talk about these large issues. Eddie, let me go back to you and even go back a couple of weeks right before Super Tuesday, when Representative Clyburn endorsed Joe Biden. That seemed to open the floodgates of voters for him. Help us understand that moment. What was revealed? And was it all about Clyburn, or was there something else at work?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with Clyburn, but we have to understand it in a much more complex way. You know, people reported Clyburn's endorsement as if he just blew a whistle and black folk got in line.
Doesn't work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't work that way, as opposed to thinking about the complex political machine that Clyburn has in South Carolina, how powerful he is, that was politics in very clear ways, in a very clear sense. But I also want to say that Clyburn's endorsement came in a moment of intense fear and panic about the possibility of the Democratic Party nominating a Democratic socialist. Mm. Right. We saw that Elizabeth Warren had entered in some kind of way a political dead space, where she couldn't be embraced by the moderates, and because she hedged, I think, on Medicare, many progressives moved to Bernie Sanders, which allowed him to consolidate the left wing of the party, and so she found herself in a dead space in terms of politics. Sanders was coming off the high of New Hampshire and Nevada, and Bloomberg was trying to buy the election with $500 million, and Clyburn came in, and that endorsement, right, I think, spoke to the fear and panic that was overwhelming the electorate. And so we've seen it since, and I think Vice President Biden has been riding that wave ever since. But that may be too narrow, but I think it has something to do with what happened.
Will, and you said you were a Elizabeth Warren supporter. Did you see that dead space that Eddie was talking about?
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, I think there were many voters who loved what Elizabeth Warren was saying and also, you know, came to really like her style. I mean, she showed a lot of leadership. I mean, look at the way that she demolished Mike Bloomberg in that one debate, for example, you know. Right. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. So so why weren't they voting for her? And I think, you know, Eddie nailed it. It was fear. And it was funny because you had this unique moment in late February where the fear was really coming from all sides. And I'm not endorsing all of these fears, but I'm just in terms of what was happening. I mean, first of all, the number one fear is the fear of Donald Trump, right? And you have to understand that in over the course of January and February, he survived this impeachment trial, and you know there was this increasing triumphalism among the Trump movement that they'd beaten impeachment. You may remember the stock market was actually at 29,000, the Dow. So you had all those things going on. So there was a lot of fear among Democrats that Trump was on this path to reelection. As Eddie's mentioned several times, you know, that a lot of established Democrats were very afraid of nominating a Democratic socialist and Bernie Sanders. I'm not as afraid. My sense is maybe Eddie's not as afraid of that as a lot of as,
not at all.
But a lot of people were,
no,
clearly.
But a lot of people were. And also, just quickly, and then Bloomberg, you know, a lot of people were like, oh, my God, this situation has become such a mess that this billionaire who really is not even a real Democrat is going to come in and buy the nomination.
Exactly.
You had all three of those things happening at the same time. And I think people were looking for a direction. And, you know, I think when you had the Clyburn endorsement and then when it was followed up by just that huge African-American vote and turnout for Biden in South Carolina, I think obviously it crystallized his support among African-American voters, which is so critical to winning the nomination. But I think for whites or for non-African-American voters, the way out of this crisis is pragmatism, people decided, you know. And, you know, I mean, the African-American vote historically has just been by and large, a very pragmatic vote. And people said, "This, look at what's happening. Look at what happened in South Carolina. This is the way forward." And everybody just fell. I've never seen anything like it. Within three days, and then you had the endorsement, Buttigieg and Klobuchar. And it's something I think, you know, we'll look back on as a remarkable moment in political history that this happened. But it also makes a lot of sense. And I think what you're seeing now is, this acceptance period of, you know, I think by and large across the spectrum, I think Democrats are accepting the fact that Joe Biden is going to be the nominee. Yeah. So the question now is not who's going to be the nominee, but what kind of nominee and what kind of president could Joe Biden be? And I mean, that's why Bernie Sanders is still in the race at this point.
Sure.
More than any other probably top American politician, he is really committed to his ideas. Well, him and Elizabeth Warren, I would say the two of them are very committed to their ideas, and they want to see as many of their ideas represented in Joe Biden's platform and his policies as they can. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, I mean, they're
they're seeing a lot of success with this.
Absolutely. Marty, just really quick. And they have a lot of support. Yeah, go ahead, Eddie. Go
just
ahead.
Really quickly, just a footnote, and then we can't underplay the or understate the profound sexism in the American electorate and how it impacted Elizabeth Warren as well. So I just wanted to make that clear, too.
I don't argue with you on that. Eddie, let me go back to you because Joe Biden said Sunday night, he said, I am going to pick a woman as a vice president. From your perspective, who would be the best woman to round out his candidacy?
You know, I think that was a really amazing political move on his part to make that announcement. And we've heard many of the other candidates prior to the winnowing of the field say something similar. We heard Cory Booker say that and others. So it was important for him to make that moment, to make that a moment on Sunday night. Let's be clear. I don't want him to make the Tim Kaine mistake.
And what would that be? I mean, obviously, it's just someone that no one's ever heard of?
Well, no. So what happens when you have the intense battle between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, a battle over the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. The Clinton folk win, and they basically thumb their nose to the progressive wing of the party by appointing, by nominating Tim Kaine, another centrist, right? So I don't think it has – you typically – and Will, I could be interested in what you say, have to say about this, and as well as you, Marty. It's typically that we think about the vice presidential nominee geographically. What demographic and region will they help bring to the ticket, right? But in this moment, we're going to have to think ideologically. How might the vice presidential nominee, quell the worries, calm the worries of the progressive wing of the party in and around Bernie Sanders, in and around Joe Biden? So he cannot, for example, choose Amy Klobuchar. It would be just everybody would throw their hands up, and I don't think a whole bunch of folk would show up, even with Trump, even with the prospect of Trump there. So I think he has to find someone who can speak to the progressive wing of the party, as well as to those women progressive women as well, who are excited about the prospects of finally having a woman in the executive branch, a vice presidential.
Eddie, do you have anyone in mind?
Not off the top of my head. You know,
no.
Folks have been. You know, the first person that comes to mind is Stacey Abrams.
Well, that's what I was thinking, but yes.
Yeah, that's the first person that comes to mind, but we'll have to think about this, right? I'm always kind of worried about representational politics or identity politics that don't come with a vetting of the actual politics that people have, but I understand the political value of this, though. I really do.
Go ahead, Will. We've got some comments I want to make sure we get on the air as well, but what are your thoughts about a VP candidate?
Well, I had a very interesting thought watching that moment, which was I noticed that He also, within the same breath, made a promise that he would place not just a woman, but a black woman on the Supreme Court, which first of all is just way overdue, and I think that would be fantastic. On the other hand, I thought it was interesting that he specified the race, that there would be a black woman on Supreme Court, but then he left it open for vice president. And obviously, I think he's considering probably women who are both both white and non-white and. But I do think, I wonder if he's putting the Supreme Court thing out there, his cover, if he does want to pick one of the white front runners. And I do think, it's interesting what Eddie said, but I do think he likes Klobuchar a lot. And I agree with Eddie that she really brings that much to the ticket. Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, is another woman who's, there is a strategy of trying to make sure you win the Rust Belt states, that Hillary lost in 2016. But I think with Biden's age, people want somebody who just seems really ready to step in on day one. And I think Kamala Harris is that person, senator from the largest state. She was attorney general, district attorney. She's got the resume. I think Stacey Abrams is fantastic. I think there'd be a lot of questions about her resume, though,
resume,
as a state legislator. Yeah.
Well, I guess all is fair in love and war and campaigning, because we know that Kamala Harris went after Joe Biden at one of those debates. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Steve, he says, I'd like to hear Biden and Trump do fireside chats explaining their ideas and policies. And now that we all have time to listen, because obviously we're hopefully home sequestered and not getting out. What do you think about that, Eddie? Not that it's going to happen, but what do you think about that?
I think it would be great. You know, I don't know. I couldn't imagine listening to Trump mangle the English language. But I think it's important that information, leadership, a kind of, how can I say it, a display of character in times of crisis is actually absolutely needed. So that would be wonderful.
An email from Rosemary. She says, if Biden agreed to champion Medicare for all, would that be enough for Bernie to suspend his campaign? How unlikely is this? Will, what do you think of that?
I think that's actually not unlikely. I think Bernie is looking possibly at an exit strategy at this point. And I think his exit strategy is how much can I get Biden to move on these issues? And, you know, I have a hard time imagining Biden endorsing all of the Medicare for All platform, because he's spoken against it so much on the campaign trail. But I do think if Biden makes some moves in that direction on healthcare, and certainly he's already moved on the so-called free college issue and some other things. I think those could be the preconditions for an early exit and a Bernie Sanders endorsement sooner rather than later. I mean the coronavirus situation creating new pressures to shut the campaign down. So he's going to look to shut it down on his terms.
And do you see Sanders having clout within the Democratic Party, Will?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Democrats are not going to win in November if young people don't turn out to vote. You know, if the daughter of Jill Stein, you know, monster, you know, crops up, you know, as a third party candidate, whoever that is, there's going to be a lot of pressure to make sure that young voters don't stay home, that they don't migrate to that candidate, you know, having Bernie Sanders on board and as a leader in the Democratic Party, I think is critical to making that happen.
And Marty, go ahead. It's so important for us to understand that these young folk have come of age amid disaster after disaster after disaster, from 9/11 to the Great Recession to ongoing war to Corona. I mean, we can just to mass shootings, that these folk have come of age, right, in a moment in which it seems as if the country, a generation before them, have just simply failed them. So it's really important that the powers that be within the Democratic Party understand that that part of the Obama coalition, they must take them seriously. Because in some ways it's the future of the party, the future of the country.
And yet we're not seeing them, Eddie, in the sort of large numbers at the polls.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people were expecting, including Senator Sanders.
Yeah, I mean, and we have to ask ourselves why that's the case. I think we need to be curious about what's happening. It has a lot to do with, we have to see, rather, whether it has anything to do with attempts to restrict their voting patterns of college students. We've seen that across the country. You know, folks cheat. We need to understand how they're cheating by impacting the ways in which typical Democratic constituencies vote, or the Democratic Party's constituencies vote. So we have that. We also might be seeing just folks, you know, playing, well, this is just simply the preseason. We're gonna wait and see what happens in the general, because that's when we really, really know what the stakes are. So, I mean, I think it's clear that young folk have behaved the way we typically think they behave politically. But the numbers are still ticking up, though, yeah. I think, overall, when we think about 2018 and the midterms and the like. We know they're going to show up in droves.
Well, my thanks to both of you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. Eddie Glaude Jr., thank you for joining us. And apparently the technology worked, so I'm very excited about that. He's a professor at Princeton University, and make sure we get a copy of your new book.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eddie. And Will Bunch, thank you as always. He's national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks, Will.
Thanks, Marty. Thanks so
You're
much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And thank you for joining us. A special, special thanks to WHYY's engineering staff, Al Banks, Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, Thad Kirk, WHYY reporter Tommy McDonald for all their technical help, for Jennifer Lynn for her help as well, Radio Times producers Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.